Welcome to Let's Talk Memoir, a podcast for memoir lovers, readers, and writers. I'm your host, Ronit Plank. I have a few announcements to share about upcoming workshops and memoir conversations, and I'd also like to share with you that I am finally on Substack and would love to have you come on over and subscribe. It is free. I am not doing any kind of paid subscriptions. I would just love to have your beautiful presence there. It's pretty new, but it is now available for you to read, as well as my newsletter on my website if you want to sign up for that. But if you love Substack, I would love to have you on my list. You can subscribe for free, and you will never miss a post about my upcoming workshops and memoir Ask Me Anythings. I'm also going to be answering questions that listeners and readers send me via message. So please subscribe to my Substack. I would love to have you there. And I will also share with you now the two upcoming offerings I have. So on May 7th, I am doing a memoir Ask Me Anything virtually with Lisa Kefauver, who is the host of the beautiful podcast Grief is a Sneaky Bitch. And we are doing this at 11 a.m. Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern time. It is free of charge, but you do need to register in advance. If you would like to find the link for that, you can find it on my Substack in my most recent post, or you can find it on my Instagram bio, or you can find it on my website, ronitplank.com. The other very exciting workshop opportunity I have coming up is a virtual retreat, an all-day virtual retreat called All About Memoir, that the host of The Shit No One Tells You About Writing, Bianca Moraes, is hosting. And on this all-day retreat, there are going to be lots of speakers, including Catherine Gildner, Chelsea Devanitz, Courtney Maum, Bonnie Reichert, Abby Maslin, and me. And each session is going to cover a different aspect of memoir writing, and it's going to be about 40 minutes of craft, and then followed by a 20-minute Q&A for people who are attending. I will be teaching the session, Putting the Plot in Your Memoir. In this session, we're going to explore the nature of plot in memoir, how to know whether you have one, tools to help eliminate the baggy parts of your manuscript, and four key elements memoirists can harness to amplify tension and stakes in their manuscripts so they crackle with resonance and momentum. I would love to see you there, and if you do register for that, please mention that I sent you. These links are all available in my Substack, in my Linktree bio in my Instagram, and also on my website, ronitplank.com. And there are links to all of those in the show notes of this podcast. Phew, I think we did everything. I think that's all there is to tell you for now. And there will be future workshops coming up this summer. I've already got two planned, and I will just keep rolling things out. I'll also have another memoir, Ask Me Anything, coming up over the summer. I would absolutely love to have you participate, and I'm so happy to be able to offer these memoir conversations and workshops. Now, without any further ado, on to the episode. Today, my guest is Kathleen Dorothy Blackburn, who teaches in the University of Chicago Creative Writing Program. She is a Pushcart Prize nominee whose work has appeared in Colorado Review, Guernica, Gulf Coast, Pleiades, and Swamp Pink, and was listed as notable in Best American Essays. Welcome, Kathleen.
Hello, Ronit. Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
I would love for you to begin by sharing a little bit about your new memoir, Loose of Earth.
Thanks so much. Yeah, this is the story of the time in my life when my family and I tried to save my father's life. I came of age in West Texas in a city called Lubbock, and I was the oldest of five children. And my parents were white Christian evangelicals, very conservative, and they were suspicious of and skeptical of public institutions of education, and they homeschooled us, and they were also very skeptical of the medical industry. They were very health conscious, and my father was a marathon runner and a former Air Force pilot who had gone with commercial airlines. He flew for American Airlines. And at the age of 38, he was stunningly diagnosed with late stage early onset colon cancer and given a short time to live. And this diagnosis threw my parents' belief system into high gear, and they rejected the recommendation to seek out chemotherapy treatments and try to extend his life a little longer that way. And instead, we started searching out faith healers all across West Texas. And there were a lot of them. And meanwhile, we committed to a very rigid diet of no preservatives and only kind of what we would call very clean eating. And this belief, the belief was that it was a kind of bootstraps religious sort of belief. Some people will recognize this as a kind of prosperity gospel, that if you believe hard enough, you can secure health and wealth through your faith. And as a result, as a child at 12 years old, I began to believe that my father's life depended on the strength of my faith. And I began to fear that if he died, it would be the result of the weakness of my faith. Mm-hmm. Now, 25 years later, in telling this story and in researching it, I learned that, you know, I mentioned he was an Air Force pilot gone commercial. He was third generation Air Force, Ronit. And I learned through researching this book that the drinking water sites where he had grown up as a child in the military and where he had worked as a military Air Forceman himself had been contaminated by carcinogenic chemicals. And so part of the context of this book is understanding a larger environmental story that we had no idea about at the time.
And it's so stunning to me because your narrator arrives, in my opinion, fully formed on the page. So we've got the character, Kathleen, who is the age that you were when this first began to unfold and goes through the illness with your family. But we also have the narrator, Kathleen, who wrote the book. And your presence on the page is needed. It's necessary. And it's fully fleshed out from the beginning, which really guides me as a reader. It really guided me the way I love memoir to guide me through your examination of what happened, and also that awareness, that the more awareness as a narrator that you didn't have when you were a child trying to figure out what was going on. So this toggling back and forth is so well done. And looking back at your story right now, you know, the way you tell it, you can see clearly what was at play. But the young you was fully immersed in this journey of trying to get your father well and the guilt on your shoulders when what was going on in the household wasn't working. Can I ask you, when did you begin to dismantle the guilt or the legacy of what had happened in your family as it relates to this religious fervor?
That's such a great question, and thank you for that description of those two selves that I think as memoirists we're always negotiating, right? That young I, you know, Virginia Woolf, the I called it the I then and the I now. It took years. I didn't begin to tell this story for 19 years, and I was a writer for quite a while before I began to unpack this particular story. So much of the story itself, I write about a particular scripture or scriptures in which that was were very important to my family and the religious circles we were in community with, was to call things that were not as though they were. And so this was not only about breaking the silence. This was about breaking away from a script that had been very important in my family. So, for instance, there's a scene in the book that occurs very close to when my father dies. It's a few weeks before he dies, and I've am with my childhood best friend, Eden, and I've just spent the night at her house. She tells me that she prays for my father every day. And we're both 13 years old. We talk about boys. We play in the rain. But I cannot in that moment as a 13-year-old even say to my best friend how afraid I am for my father's life. I can't describe what's happening at home to her. Instead, what I say is, he's going to be better real soon. And this is a few weeks before he dies from cancer. And so he's very emaciated at this point. Mm-hmm. I have seen, you know, the signs of his ailing body would be vivid to any mm-hmm. stranger who saw him. So, you know, it took, the psychological aftermath of that kind of adherence mm-hmm. to a family code, to a religious script, can be so long-lasting and I think could have been permanent. I think the combination for me was years later, a huge reason I was able to tell this story was because I had developed skills in the craft of writing. And I don't know if you feel this way, but there's a part of me that believes that there was some part of my brain that knew that once I sort of had the skills to hold this story, it was released. I honestly mm-hmm. did not think about it for almost 20 years. And then a sort of series of interesting events, it was sort of released and, mm-hmm. and I started writing it. Yeah.
You know, something that I wanted to ask you, which I'm not sure, I'm kind of hitting you with this question without having prepared either of us, but did it ever occur to you to tell the story from only a child narrator? Because this comes up sometimes, there's a lot of question in memoir about child narrators, and there are workshops on that in particular. And I always am gratified to see a child being narrated by, of course, the adult in the room, the narrator, and, you know, holding both the character, child, and the narrator, the now mm-hmm. writer. Did it ever occur to you not to, or were there ever moments where you had a hard time dividing the two?
You know, I worked on this book for 6 years, and the first 4 years, I wrote it entirely from the adult perspective in the past tense. Mm-hmm. And after that fourth year, I thought that it was done. You know, I thought the manuscript was ready. And I had a very close mentor read it, and she had some honest feedback for me in which it was clear that some restructuring needed to happen. And the story needed, it still wasn't quite there. And Ronit, I couldn't find my way back into it. I sort of describe working on structure of a book this way, that it's almost like when your hand is, when you've been holding on to something really tightly, mm-hmm. and then you let go, your hand still holds that shape for a second. That's sort of what my brain does when in working on a project. Mm-hmm. So it took me a while to find my way in. And I read Kristen Iverson's Full Body Burden, which is an incredible environmental memoir, is one of the ways we might talk about that book. And that book is written in the present tense, and it starts when she's quite young, with that, it's from that child's perspective, but of course, you know, written with a context that only an adult could have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like to, when I'm teaching, I like to talk to my students about that, you know, that movement between the I now and the I then. I like to talk about something I call the reverse country western song move. You know, in country western music, we talk about, you know, if I knew then what I know now, you know, here are all the things I'd do better and do differently, and then maybe I wouldn't have lost the girl. But I think that there's something to be said for, if I knew now what I knew then. But there's a knowledge that we have as children mm-hmm. or in our youth that as we age, we lose a little bit of the touch with. And I, even though there's so much in this story that is painful and difficult, there was something about this younger self, this younger Kathleen, that she knew that I didn't know anymore, that I couldn't fully access anymore. And I wanted a way to get as close to that as possible. Mm-hmm. And so to answer your question, and after that fourth year, I went back in and thought, I'm going to listen to her. I'm going to let this young self, I mean, it's an artifice, of course, but as much as possible, let this young 12-year-old speak. And there's a moment in the book, kind of towards the end, where I stage a sort of imagined encounter where I say, you know, if I could collapse the years between us and appear before my 13-year-old self, I'd have some answers for her. I basically could tell her everything that's going to happen. But she wouldn't listen to me. You know, she has her own strength and she has her own truth in that moment. And it's a collision. It's a conflict. It's an encounter. And in a way, that reflective move becomes one of antagonism between the present and the past. Mm-hmm. And so while I didn't let the child self do all of the narrating, I really wanted to listen to her and not to undermine her, the truth of her experience with what I know now.
Yeah, well, thank you for reflecting on that. That is, I do love talking about that aspect of memoir so much. So what about this narrative thread in your book about the history of Lubbock and the legacy of contaminants and forever chemicals? When did you know, this is definitely going to be part of my memoir?
Well, I started researching the places where my father had lived out of a basic principle that I have in writing memoir, that place is an essential character in story for me. And I wanted to know more about the things he had seen and smelled and heard and looked at. I wanted to know more about those landscapes. I also wanted to know more about him. You know, he's been gone now 25 years, and I started the book 19 years after he had died. And so I wanted a clearer picture of who he was, especially as a teenager. And so I found his high school classmates. Shout out to Judson High, class of 77. Mm-hmm. and a lot of them agreed to let me interview them. Mm. And one of them, when in our conversation, when we were just talking about what he was like in high school, asked me how he had died. And at this point, what I know now is that, you know, when my father was diagnosed with cancer in 1997, no one else in the family, in his immediate family, had had a cancer diagnosis. But at this point, everyone in his immediate family has had a cancer diagnosis and a lot of relatives as well. And so it's a big problem in the family. We think there's a genetic component, but those tests have been inconclusive. And when I told his old high school classmate that, she said, well, do you know about the water? And I had been working on the book for about 2 years at that point. And I said, what are you talking about? And she turned me on to this issue that's an unfolding and live issue right now, which, as you mentioned, is the fact that PFAS, which a lot of us know about, are euphemizes forever chemicals, which are just an insidious group of carcinogenic chemicals that were originally used in nonstick products, Scotchgard products, Teflon pans, and were used in firefighting foams by the military widely in firefighting drills. They were very effective in putting out petroleum fires that started on planes and ships. Mm-hmm. And where routinely fire drills were run on Air Force sites and naval sites, and then these foams put out the fires within seconds, and then were just rinsed down the fields, and they were pretty carelessly drained into nearby streams and wastewater plants and the soil and so on. And the sites where my father had lived and where he had worked have particularly high contamination from PFAS. And when I very first Googled PFAS Air Force Texas, my hometown, Lubbock, and the now shuttered Air Force Base of Reese was the first site to come up. And I was stunned because that's my backyard. And I had no idea. So that blew the memoir open.
Oh, yeah. I imagine that would have been haunting or sent chills down your spine when you saw that.
Absolutely. And often that is how those of us working in this kind of storytelling, that's often what we end up discovering. You know, Carrie Arsenault in her book Milltown talks about this. These sorts of environmental contaminants hide in plain sight. They're diffuse. They're deliberately obscured. They're a part of almost every story. They're either normalized and or we don't see them as such. And so it was very haunting and continues to be.
In the earlier stages of working on the memoir, what do you remember challenging you a lot? And then as you got deeper into revision, did those challenges change or were they the same?
The earliest stages were so... The first draft I wrote almost in like a fever dream, and I was really lucky because I was in graduate school and I wrote it in the summer, so I had some time off. And I say that I was lucky. It was not only that I had time, I could be in a pretty emotional mess. That draft was very raw, and I was in a raw place writing it because it was a return. It had taken so much energy to manicure and manage my grief and repress those memories. And it all came undone in a matter of, really, honestly, it came undone in like a matter of a day. And then it took me about a month to write the first draft of the book. So it was an incredible psychological and emotional experience. I say in the book that it felt like a nervous breakdown, and I still think it was. There's an irony, I think, that happens when we're writing, which is that early draft feels closest to you. At least it felt closest to me. And then through revision, I started to gain a little bit of distance, I guess, because I became so obsessed with the craft of it, the research, expanding the sensory details, understanding the context, the larger context of the story, remembering as much as I could, interviewing people, you know, all of that started to flesh it out. And I think as a result, I hope that now the book can feel closer to the reader because of that work, even though I've gained, even as I have gained a little more distance from it. That said, when I read it, the copy edited version, you know, you work on it and you work on it. And then when I got the copy edits back, and my only job was just to sit and read it, not with a pen in hand, I cried again, you know, and I thought a part of me couldn't believe that it existed.
Thank you. So there's so much happening within your book, and among the rich narrative elements is also a sibling story. In the book, especially, you mention your younger sister, I think it's your youngest sister, being afraid of reading your memoir, but she did.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how your other siblings have reacted or anything around the siblings.
Yes, I'd be happy to. You know, we've all been quiet about this past. And Mary Catherine, the youngest, and she's named in the book as Mary Catherine. She wanted me to use her actual name. She was one of the readers I had in mind when I was writing this. She was 2 years old when our father died. And she grew up in the wake of that loss and in the mystery of it, because there was so much shame and pain that followed, and that was manifested through a lot of silence. And I thought when I would lose my way in the story, I would think of her, because when I speak to her, we have such a code of intimacy and of honesty. And I wanted to write with that voice, and I wanted to tell the truth in that way, and thinking of her would help me find my way back into the story. My other siblings, they all know that the memoir exists, and you know, and I write about this a little bit in the epilogue. There's still a lot of silence around the past when it comes to them, and I don't know. I know what an extraordinary experience it was for me to have these memories unlocked and to set them to paper. And I know, you know, I mentioned earlier that I felt that I was ready as a writer to receive them. I also have done a lot of therapy. You know, some people say, you know, is writing memoir therapeutic? And I've said, you know, I had to go into therapy to write this memoir.
Yeah, yeah.
But what they have given me, and it's a gift, is they have said that they understand that I had to write this book. I don't know that they're going to read it, and I understand that. So that's where things are. I think some mutual respect that we're each kind of pursuing the reckoning in our own way.
Yeah, it's interesting when you're talking about it. It makes me think, of course, who would willingly, knowingly step into the pain, right?
Yes.
Why would we do that to ourselves? If you haven't been immersed in it, if you haven't been, you know, rummaging around in there for the many years that you have, why would you invite that into your life?
Yes.
And at the same time, I think those of us who have kind of gone digging and gone through a lot of this work, whether on the page or in therapy or both, I'll speak for myself. I'm of the school of thought that why wouldn't you want a more clear rendering of your life? Why would you not want to step into that kind of way of living without being afraid, right, of
yes.
what you might find?
Yes.
But of course, it's not for everyone. And that's right. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Do you think you could read from the section we talked about on page 104, chapter 13?
I would be honored. My mother is, at this point in the story, my father has been diagnosed with cancer. We have committed to a very extreme diet of the clean eating, no preservatives in the house, no white flour, no white sugar. And she makes bread from scratch. And when she's not in the kitchen doing that, she's looking up scriptures about healing. And that's where this picks up. Mom weaves between the kitchen and the computer desk, between bread and verse. At her keyboard, she types up scriptures in Times New Roman 14-point font and prints them on blue index cards. She is boycotting metaphor. Where the Old Testament prophets wrote heal, they meant it literally. Looking back across the space of over two decades, I want to slow down here and try to get a clearer picture of my younger self. Where is my own movement amid the bustle of my mother's? I can picture myself leaning against the doorway to the schoolroom, watching her type. I feel the air part as she brushes past me to check on the bread. But memory offers glimpses of little more than a statue of a 12-year-old. The details around my mother sitting at the computer desk crystallize. They reveal the intensity of the time, my awareness, and my ability to deeply observe. But the spotlight on my mother also keeps my dismissal of myself in shadow. I was not at the time paying close attention to what I thought or the physical sensations passing through my body. Though I had inherited my father's love for story, I often didn't consider myself a prominent actor in the narrative of my life. Like my mother, I would become obsessed with words, but I did not at the time try to find the meaning for what I was experiencing. I am grateful for what I remember. But memory is itself a storyteller, and my memory did not, in moments like these, consider me one of the main characters. I am keenly aware, in retrospect, that my recollections are often shorn of the one remembering. A part of me was coping with trauma by going numb. It's also true that while my parents loved their children, they did not often think of us as persons with reflections of our own. My mother, in particular, rarely asked me what I was thinking, feeling, or needing. I was even less attuned than usual to my inner feelings in the early days of my father's diagnosis, because that's where doubt might reside. I could will myself to believe in a miracle if I ignored my senses and instincts, which perceived the changes in my father's body. But what's not there in my recollections tells a story too, and I can feel in the absence of a fuller portrait of my younger self a painful irony, the presence of a young girl's attempt to survive.
Thank you. We learn so much about your mother and how closely attuned you are to her as a child, and the pain there is palpable. And a lot of what the narrator you observed, it seems to have been unspoken for the character you, which makes sense because, you know, you had to survive and be there and do the rules of the family. Where are you now with your mother in your relationship, literally, and then also interiorly, when you think about what occurred in your childhood, how do you relate to your mother?
You know, I just saw my mother last weekend for the first time in a year and a half. I'm in Chicago. She's still in Lubbock. She's still in that same house. We don't talk about the past very much. And, you know, once Ronit, a therapist asked me once, what would you say if your mother were to ask you, what is your version of what happened, Kathleen? And without a second thought, I said to the therapist, everything I write is an answer to that question. When I think back to my childhood with my mom, on the one hand, I think that it was so there were some surprising choices were made, you know, some complicated choices were made. And I think I write about them pretty honestly. But I also think about what she was going through. And the truth is that she was a 38 and then 39-year-old woman with five children who loved her husband and was watching him die, despite what she believed and despite what she told herself about being able to save his life through her faith, through baking bread. And I want to quickly share, when I was in Texas, she was sitting with me and we were having tea. And she said to me kind of out of the blue just this last weekend, you know, she said, it occurred to me, you know, you are the exact age I was when your father died, which is true, I am. And my son is the exact age that Mary Catherine, my youngest sister, was. And she said, do you ever think about that? And I just burst into tears. And she started crying. And then we held each other and we wept. And it was so sacred to share that together. So, and I don't think we've ever had a moment like that in our lives. We don't talk about the memoir, and she's congratulated me. But that moment of an extension of seeing some part of herself and me, and I said to her, I think about it all the time. I think about it all the time, Mom, that I am the age you were, and I am so sorry for what you went through. So that felt really important, you know, that mm-hmm. felt really, it was a gift.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And this idea too, that she was connecting you to and seeing you, which I think in parts of the memoir, you talk about not being seen by her.
Yes.
And in fact, there's a section, I think you've just turned 13 on page 168, that little paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to read that?
I'd love to. So I've just turned 13 and I had long hair all up until this point in my life. And I've just had it all cut off mm-hmm. to chin length. And I'm at the salon. I wish to be completely alone, to rest on my elbows, chin in my hands, and study my jaw, see all the angles. More than anything, I don't want to be anywhere near my mother. I don't want her to witness this reveal. I can't bear to look at her for fear I'll see a condescending grin, or worse, more tears. I fear, above all, that she will see the woman I am becoming and, what, give me more responsibility, quash me, take what she sees and try to shape it into something else.
Thank you. It was very hard to pick what to have you read, but what I wanted to talk about with this section was this compartmentalizing or protecting of yourself you needed to continue to do, or that you were doing then. And I'm wondering, you know, after your father passes away and book ends, you do have sort of an epilogue and talk about what happened later in a very, you know, just some brush strokes.
Yes.
But I'm wondering what your later adolescent years with your mother were like, if you continued to need to protect yourself. And of course, I know this could be a whole nother memoir, but if you could just, I'm just so curious because, you know, I live in a very mother-daughter space in my writing, of course, as
yes,
you know.
Yes. Well, it is going to be another memoir. This book extended into the aftermath of my father passing away. It was clear to me that that would be a separate book that I'm working on currently. The aftermath was brutal. It was absolutely mm-hmm. brutal. My mother went through the extreme grief of losing my father. And he was soothing to her. He helped her find what balance she was able to find. She's a person of extremes. And I also say that as someone who is I'm not a moderate person. I'm an all or nothing kind of person as well. And so I absolutely, you know, when I, one of the themes of our conversation, I think, Ronit, has been, how did I come to eventually tell the story? And when I say there were 19 years of silence, a big part of that was the need to be quiet and to be still and to hold my stories and my opinions inside, because the consequences could be very harsh when she didn't agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment I've described of sharing in our grief and crying together, that was a first. And I'm 39 mm-hmm. years old.
Mm-hmm.
So no, what I saw in the mirror and what I knew in that day in the salon was that it was not always safe to be seen by her.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and actually that leads right into that last section I'm hoping you can read on page 169.
Yes, yes. Very often in my youth, I felt unseen by my mother. At least that was the word I used to describe the feeling to myself. But it was more complicated than that. Her observations of me often pained her, as when she grieved at the sight of my white blonde strands piling on the salon tiles. Or what she saw resulted in more responsibility for me, more training, more discipline. She left me to care for my siblings, took me to the clinic instead of enrolling me in school, and tasked me with praying for miracles because, in each instance, she had concluded that I'd reached a new benchmark. These were the ways in which she acknowledged my young adulthood. In her mind, these were the privileges of maturity. It wasn't that my mother didn't see me. I could feel her eyes like a harsh light. I just didn't like what she did with what she saw. This was true at the time and has largely remained true.
Thank you. So I'm wondering about this approach to your material. It's so, as I've said before, I feel like you have a lot of intimacy and courage in the writing of the memoir. There's so much of you and it's so personal. And I just feel like you're holding the reader in this intimate family space with you, which was very close quarters. You were homeschooled and mm-hmm. religious, and
yes,
it was just, there's no real outlet, you know? And then when you juxtapose that with your relationship with your mother, which seemed incredibly guarded and complex, and this enmeshment with you and the family members with so few boundaries. So what is it like, I'm wondering, to share with readers your truth and experience when it seems like you couldn't or maybe can't do that with your mother and some of your family?
That's such an insightful question. You know, in an earlier version of this excerpt that I've just read, I did say something rather explicitly about how I'm able to share with an anonymous reader more mm-hmm. than I have ever been able to talk about with my own family.
Yeah. And I have to say, like, bookmark that for a second, because part of what I feel like you're really young, right? I know you're yes. the oldest that you've ever been, but compared to other memoir writers, I feel like you've done some rapid, and I know you've said you're a writer and that must be part of it, you know, the writing and the therapy, but I feel like you've done some rapid unpacking and rapid excavating and been able to access so much of what your story is about, even though you had it really contained for so long.
Mm. You know what, I think we know that memories are stored in different parts of the brain depending on what kind of memory they are. And I think one of the, you know, that word rapid, when the memories kind of came unleashed as they did for me in the summer of 2017, they were fresh. They had not been mulled over many times. They had been preserved in a kind of capsule. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the work there was that encounter with their kind of freshness, because a lot of them were attached to trauma in part. You know, we know that we understand from trauma studies that painful traumatic memories are stored in a sort of different place than other memories. And I think that must have been part of it for me. And I also think, you know, that there's contract that we enter into as writers of memoir that's one of honesty and of vulnerability. And I had studied it and I had practiced it. I had the tools. I don't know that I could sit in a room and tell this story, just tell it. But on the page, that space is, the invitation was there. The invitation to tell the story as fully and completely. And the language itself got me through.
So how did you take care of yourself? I know that you mentioned you were in therapy that summer, which I think a lot of us are. But how did you take care of yourself in addition to therapy when you were working with this grief and these visceral memories? And even when you read it again, you said after the copy edit and stuff, and you weren't marking it up, you were just reading it. How did you take care of yourself? Because this is really something that comes up for a lot of memoirists.
Mm, that's a great question. I was talking with a former student just yesterday as she's trying to decide where she might go to graduate school. And I was thinking about what really hinders writing. And one of the things I said is attaching yourself to someone who isn't supportive of your writing. I had a very, very supportive partner who was the first person to tell me when I started to, you know, make little mutterings about this church I had gone to as a child, that I had had a book in there. And that was one of the ways I took care of myself, was by connecting with people who would believe in me when I couldn't, because there were plenty of moments of self-doubt and despair along the way. Another way was, just to get really practical, I worked on other projects along the way, other essays that had nothing to do with this book. I took breaks. You know, if it wasn't, I'm a very disciplined writer, but if it wasn't there, I would let myself work on something else. If the words weren't coming, if I couldn't find my way in, if I was emotionally drained, or if going into the space of the memoir meant that I couldn't function very well that day, but I needed to because I had to go teach a class or go to some meeting or something, then I would try to compartmentalize and say, I'll work on it on a day when it's okay for me to, mm-hmm. you know, be a bit of a mess that day. So I think that there's these practical considerations too. You know, give your mind and your writing soul a break and a chance to fill, either by reading or working on other projects, and then trust it with people who believe in it more than you do. So you can be a self, you know, that's the uncertainty and the doubt. When it's mm-hmm. there, you can be held up by somebody else. That's how I did it.
Thank you. Thanks for reflecting on that. I know it's a lot of hard work. Yeah. So you mentioned two books during our conversation. Are there any other memoirs you'd like to recommend?
Well, I loved Sarah Broom's The Yellow House. That's a gorgeous book of personal storytelling that also thinks about these contexts of environmental history and I think that that's just a gorgeous one. And then I am now reading Karen Savage's Ground Glass, which is a lovely, devastating lyric memoir about the ways that our bodies carry place is both a literal thing and place as memory and relationships with community and family. And it's just gorgeous.
Great. Thank you. I'll put those in the show notes. And you've been giving advice throughout our conversation, but is there any last words of advice? Are there any last words that you'd like to share with writers working on their memoirs?
The thing that helped me the most was I wrote like nobody would ever see it. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got away from the tyrants within my own mind. So that's what I would say, is just write like nobody's ever going to see it. And I think that's how I was also able to create so much intimacy. Well, I hope it was intimacy on the page. You know, that's the irony is by imagine, you know, just getting out of my own way. I think I was able to, I hope, invite the reader very closely in.
You definitely did. And it was just, it's been a joy to talk with you. Where can people find you?
Well, come out and see me, please. I'll be on a on a book tour in Texas, parts of Texas, and in Chicago and in Washington, D.C. So you can check that out at my website, which is KD Blackburn, kdblackburn.com. And you can also find my email there. So please reach out, send me a note. I love to hear from readers and other writers alike.
Great. Kathleen, thank you so much for spending this time with me and for, you know, sharing your experience writing this beautiful book.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm such a fan of your work and your podcast. Thank you for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk Memoir. For more about this episode and my guest, please visit the link in the show notes or on Instagram at Ronit Plank. That's RonitPlank. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. If you liked this episode of Let's Talk Memoir, please go ahead and share it with your friends and subscribe. And if you have two more seconds, you can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, which really does help other people find the show. thank you so much for being here.